My name is Michael Kossa from the Democracy, Governance and Service Delivery Research Program, and I'm going to be chairing this session this afternoon. The session is on, it's entitled, A Blue Economy for Women's Economic Empowerment, and there are two authors of this work. The one is here with us, Professor Jolene Steyn-Kotzer, and then the other one is Professor Maunia Bowler-Muller. Just to tell you a little bit about the two researchers, Jolene is a senior research specialist in the Democracy, Governance and Service Delivery Program at the HSRC. She was previously an associate professor of political studies at the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University, when it was still metropolitan. She is the former president of the South African Association for Political Studies, 2014-16, and the current editor of the journal Politicon, South African Journal of Political Studies. She leads the South African chapter on gender and transformation in the IHURA academic group. And then the co-author is Professor Maunia Bowler-Muller, who is the executive director of the same program, Democracy, Governance and Service Delivery. She's also an adjunct professor at the University of Fort Hare, and she currently chairs the IHURA academic group and has contributed substantially to building the blue economy as a research focus area. Her research interests include gender equality, international and constitutional law. She has a PhD in law, human rights and democracy. So I think with that introduction, let me say thank you to Jolene for being here to present on this very important work.
Thank you. And thank you very much for the opportunity as well for us just to share this project and this project's journey and also some of our key findings, which we are hoping will have quite a substantial impact on the gender and women's economic empowerment agenda within IHURA moving forward. This was very much a collaborative piece of work. As we can see, I've listed all the researchers there, myself, Kanania, Dr. Stephen Gordon, Dr. Emmanuel Sekiere, Dr. Gabaza Malukele, and Ms. Tobekile Sikale. Everybody contributed essentially to this particular project, and we can see it was quite a rich collaborative project with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office from the United Kingdom, the Center for Gender and African Studies at the University of the Free State, and then, of course, DGSD within the HSRC. So for today, and I'm hopeful I won't be boring you too much and it won't be too long, we're just going to start off with a brief introduction and background, unpacking the blue economy and how it links to the notion of women's economic empowerment, the state of women in the blue economy, and that is quite important because one needs a baseline to determine exactly what is the state of women within IHURA countries that one can capitalize on building a blue economy for women's economic empowerment. Just a secondary data analysis of women's economic empowerment in the blue economy. We focus on labor force participation in education, for example. And then just what emerged from our elite stakeholder interviews and mapping the way forward and our conclusions and recommendations. And I forgot to add that Dr. Michael Kossa next to me was the project manager on this particular project. So when we look at the Indian Ocean Rim Association, now the Indian Ocean Rim Association is a regional organization of countries that borders the Indian Ocean. So inevitably, blue economy and sustainable development through oceans and an oceans economy becomes quite important for the future developmental agenda of the region. It requires collaborative interaction between states that borders the Indian Ocean and within this context of sustainable development within the Indian Ocean, women's economic empowerment through a blue economy becomes a central focus. And we see that in the IORA policy documents and within the IORA narrative. Now, in 2018, last year, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office commissioned a report to essentially provide IORA member states with technical assistance on how we can strengthen women's economic empowerment in the blue economy with a focus on the Indian Ocean. And our primary objective was to provide an outcome report that would give this technical support so that member states are able to realize the cross-cutting themes of blue economy and women's economic empowerment as per the IORA action plan. Now, just briefly, if one looks at IORA, there are a number of priority areas. Well, generally 6 priority areas and then 2 cross-cutting themes. And your blue economy and women's economic empowerment are the cross-cutting issues that actually informs all the other different areas, from maritime safety and security, trade and investment, fisheries management. Blue economy and women's economic empowerment are issues that these priority areas and those who work in these priority areas need to consider. And ultimately, the goal is to address those mutual developmental aspirations, but to ensure that we have inclusive growth and sustainable development. And development cannot be sustainable and inclusive if women are excluded from that process. I would go further and say not just women, but marginalized communities as a whole to create that inclusivity. So within the blue economy sector itself, what we find are also focus areas, tourism, science and technology. We're looking at seaports and shipping, fisheries and aquaculture, and so forth. So IORA has essentially established key focus areas for development. And within those focus areas of development in the blue economy, women's economic empowerment needs to take the center stage. There's just a brief outline of kind of the policy development of women's economic empowerment, which ironically enough is a relatively new area within the IORA space. And if we look at blue economy, also a relatively new area within the IORA policy space. So it is something that is new and that is continuing to develop. This just gives one an idea of what the priority areas are for IORA as a regional organization, specifically related to the blue economy and women's economic empowerment. And one can see they have set up short-term, medium-term, and long-term plans. And our purpose was to provide technical support for IORA to really achieve more of those medium and long-term plans as well. So we have seen the establishment of a Women's Economic Empowerment Working Group. We have seen the establishment of a working group on blue economy. Now, of course, the question now is how those groups will collaborate to pursue and advance initiatives where we can see a blue economy for women's economic empowerment. So again, just our brief project assignment and who we are, the Statutory Science Council of South Africa, and that we responded to this policy proposal specifically to deliver an outcome report, provide technical advice and support, and then attend selected meetings in order to share our research findings. For this particular project, we drew on a policy analysis, a secondary quantitative analysis, and key informant interviews to really try and use limited resources, of which time, all this work was done in 3 months, as Michael would recall, loads of coffee. Time was a very, very limited resource for us, so we really had to try and build the richest possible foundation in order to provide this technical support in achieving a blue economy for women's economic empowerment. Now, everybody is talking about the green revolution, right? The climate crisis, we're talking about sustainable development, environmental justice, development with the eye of future generations. And the blue economy kind of links in to that narrative. The idea of the blue economy really looks to advance economic development, social inclusion, enhance livelihoods, while ensuring environmental sustainability of the oceans. As opposed to the green economy, which focuses on let's say, land-based development, a blue economy really looks at oceans initiatives and ocean-based development. And within the oceans, there is a strong recognition that there is an ecosystem. And ecosystem services provided by the oceans are important for those global priorities. So if you think oceans, renewable energy, for example, with wave technology, it is conceptualized as an alternative model of development, a paradigm shift to really facilitate that inclusive and sustainable growth that dominates international policy discourses, but at the same time generating employment, and not just employment for the sake of employment, but really inclusive employment. So when we start looking at conceptualizing the blue economy and how it links to women's economic empowerment, there are a number of themes that do come up. Responsible economic activity, inclusive development for job creation, environmental protection for future sustainability, social justice, and overall human well-being. Now, this isn't necessarily unique to the conceptualization of the blue economy. It is something that we are talking about when we talk about the climate crisis, for example. Now, when you look at advancing women's economic empowerment through the blue economy, Iora states have really committed themselves specifically to the women's economic principles as advocated by United Nations Women. They also ran a project concurrently to ours looking at the women's economic principles and how that can facilitate women's economic empowerment as well. It's essentially a seven-step guide. Under the banner of equality means business. So really trying to focus on creating that equal level playing field for women as they start their own businesses or entrepreneurial activities, or as they enter the workplace, that they have an equal footing with their male counterparts. And essentially, the focus areas of the women's empowerment principles, business case, look at gender diversity, issues of poverty reduction, international and regional action to make sure that there's that dialogue, that international action, women's movements, really looking at how one can consolidate that agenda using a gender lens. So when we look at what is women's economic activity, how women engage in entrepreneurial activity or in the workplace, that we do so through a gendered lens of practices, policies, strategies, and initiatives. Consider, for example, maternity leave. All women sitting for a job interview and being asked, are you planning to have children? Which is generally questions men won't get in a job interview situation. And the idea to create multi-stakeholders, really achieving gender equality through participation and engagement with all actors involved. Now, when we embarked on this project, we broke it up into phases. The first phase was looking at the state of women in Iora. The second phase was very much what we call a gender policy mainstreaming perspective. We drew on the four R's of gender mainstreaming: representation, resources, rights, realities, in engaging in what is the policy narrative and discourse, and how one can look at that through really a gendered lens in setting up a policy directive for Iora to pursue. Now, when we talk about representation, who participates? What is the proportion of participation between men and women? We drew on some quantitative data there to try and determine who participates, what is the proportion of participation in employment, in education. But one can also take it a step further. When there's a women's conference, for example, who generally participates in a women's conference? Are women. So So there's also a need to bring men into that conversation. Resources. Who gets what? You know, if you think, for example, the different resources distributed between men and women. So think of a guest house, a privately run guest house. So a woman in the household would do quite a lot of unpaid work in order to keep that business sustainable, but she might not necessarily be paid for her work. Again, we draw on quantitative data there. Rights. What are the legal conditions? Are there laws against discrimination in the workplace? Do we find equity policies, gender equity policies within the workplace? Do men and women get paid the same for the same work and so forth? Do men and women enjoy equal rights in all aspects of life? And that is more of a qualitative methodology that one would use there because it starts looking at experience. And then the reality. Why is the situation the way it is? Why do women tend to lag behind? What are some of the key perceptions or societal values that impact on the ability of women to empower, well, the ability of women to empower themselves? I think we also need to move away from a narrative that says women are in need of empowerment and we're going to empower them, but look at a narrative where we speak of a woman's ability to empower herself. So with all of that said, and again looking at the blue economy and women's economic empowerment, there was a deep recognition that women have played an important economic role in the Indian Ocean for generations, either in the informal sector and in the fishing markets, you know, through being hostesses in guest houses, or whichever way it goes, making crafts, for example, that are sold at tourism markets. But what we did find is that patriarchal social and economic structures actually prevented the full inclusion of women into the activities of the blue economy. We have seen an established body of work around that. We did a very solid What is the State of Women in Iora in 2017, and we found exclusion, over-concentration of women in the informal economy, of the blue economy, a lack of education, cultural attitudes to gender equality. All of these became barriers to women's economic empowerment. But in essence, these are barriers that women need to overcome that men don't necessarily have to in order to be fully included. So for us, in order for Iora to really fulfill its policy promise made in the Jakarta Declaration, where the organization committed to women's economic empowerment, the blue economy space needs to be opened up to try and facilitate that equal participation of men and women as per the women's empowerment principles advocated by United Nations Women. Interestingly enough, one of our case studies detailed women in fishing in Tanzania and their participation in the fishing industry, actual fishing, going out on boats and fishing, declined steadily over a number of years. And then it emerged that they didn't have sufficient access to scuba diving equipment, which their male counterparts had. And as such, they were unable to run their business sustainably. And that was a question of economics, but it was also a question of cultural attitudes towards women don't belong on the sea, they belong on land in order to process what we as men bring from the oceans. That gives you just a very, very broad overview of what the actual earmarked goals of the Iora Action Plan is. Gender-focused capacity building and business development initiatives, for example. Really transmitting women's empowerment principles that it becomes a part and parcel of normal business dealings. So it's interesting to see that on the one hand, you've got this narrative that we have to create space for the empowerment of women. And as I will demonstrate later, that there are some strong barriers that can really limit the space that you are able to create. So, what is the state of women in the blue economy? It's It was a very fascinating study, and this particular aspect of the study proved one of the most challenging, I would say, especially because of the lack of data. Now, as I've indicated, the blue economy is not a traditional industry in the traditional sense of the word. You know, you are dealing with oceans and an oceans economy. And what we found is that statistics agencies generally did not capture the necessary data that we needed. So if we wanted to know how many women were involved in seabed mining in Oman, for example, we would not be able to track that data. So it became quite difficult to really try and understand what is the full extent of gender participation in this context. And with that disclaimer, we shall carry on. So data on blue economy related employment is very fragmented. And even when there is data available, a cross-national comparison is also extremely difficult because people may not necessarily capture the same types of statistics. We found that data might not be gender disaggregated. So again, if it's not gender disaggregated, we cannot really say this is how many women who participate in seabed mining or oceans renewable energy, for example. And this is not just the case in Iora countries with weak central governments or that are currently in conflict, but it is something that we kind of found across the board. So when we started looking at fisheries and aquaculture, yes, it's a sector that has seen significant growth. Predominantly Asian member states contribute the most to the overall output of fisheries and aquaculture. This is also an area where women can really, really make an impact. We know that the Food and Agriculture Organization has been gathering data on female involvement in aquaculture and fisheries since the 1970s. And when we started asking for this information, we almost got a little disclaimer to say, you know, the data may change, which would make anybody a bit uncomfortable if you have to try and paint a picture of how many women are involved in Iora states within fisheries and aquaculture. Some offices only reported men. And we don't know whether it's because no women were involved or because the data simply wasn't captured as was needed. So what we found, notwithstanding the poor quality of data, women are predominantly associated with the post-harvest phase, processing, sitting in the market, cleaning fish, getting it ready to be sold at market and so forth, in many states and many parts of the Indian Ocean. We simply do not know enough about gender equalities and inequalities in the fisheries and aquaculture value chain. So what we found is the perception is men go out to fish, women get the fish at the beach and they start processing it for sale at the post-harvest for the market. So, but we have to ask, like, where does the post-harvest chain actually start? Where does it end? Where would women fit in? Where can we create space where women can start playing a more predominant role in some of perhaps the male-dominated aspects of this particular industry? So we know women in the Indian Ocean often do not have the necessary access to resources. As I mentioned, the case of Tanzania. Sorry, my presentation disappeared. I'm just going to get this on my laptop quickly.
That's fine, I'll just end it. And go to maybe somebody drained.
Technology?
Yeah, no problem. Can you come?
Technology always. Oh, okay, I'm also getting it. Which might help. I forgot my glasses in the office, so I'm struggling to see with the white what's going on there. Anyway. Cultural roles, cultural stereotypes. You know, that old saying. Women belong in the kitchen barefoot. Yes, I see a couple of solid nods in the room here. You know, those types of attitudes matter. And we do need to look at those social conventions and how one is going to break them down to facilitate women's economic empowerment. Because there are always these types of stereotypes that do impact on women's economic empowerment. The decline of marine resources also negatively impacts on the ability of women to really gain an equal footing in this industry. Vulnerability. Very often employment laws either do not exist or they are poorly designed and inadequately enforced. A lack of support, a lack of political will. Protection at work, for example. Protection of entrepreneurial opportunities. All of these things impact on the ability of women to really, really make an inroad in fisheries and aquaculture, which again is an area where one can really expand to create an inclusive space, developmental space. So when we started looking at seaports and shipping, again, it was quite interesting. We know the global supply of seafarers has increased. Again, IORA's Asian member states have supplied many qualified officers and personnel, and yet it is estimated that approximately 1% of seafarers are women. So again, women largely excluded from this particular industry. There is a culture of stereotyping and discrimination. There are issues that women face when they take up positions of leadership or positions that are seen as traditionally male on ships. Mostly women are in the non-technical aspect of the industry, if you think cruise ships, for example, working in tourism. But when you start looking at female ship masters, chief engineers, and any other officers, women's health and safety. Consider, for example, pregnancy. Is there sufficient support and access to health for pregnant women? High risk of harassment. We've heard horror stories of female seafarers who were raped, for example, and then tossed overboard so that they wouldn't report the incident. Sexual assault. And these women are then isolated at sea with little or no support. So it does demonstrate that there kind of is a need to change a little bit on how we do what we do in the seaports and shipping arena. And digital transformation, and I know everybody's talking about 4IR, and you know it's a hot topic right now, but within this context, you know, as we see this digital transformation of shipping, we can actually mobilize and create space for highly skilled roles for women. Training opportunities in software and mechatronic engineering, for example. Artificial intelligence-driven services, operations. All of these things can create that inclusive space for women in this particular area, but it would require a strong focus on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education for women to be able to capitalize on this. And a similar point is made when we start looking at marine biotechnology research and development. Because essentially, yes, new oceans technologies can provide these opportunities, but because we don't know cross-nationally and by gender how many women are actually involved in marine biotechnology research and development, we need to start looking somewhere else. So we need to perhaps start looking at how many women are enrolled for advanced degrees in science, in maths, in technology, that we have more of an integrated approach to science and technology and innovation in the region. You do have the RCSTT, I always struggle with that, which is a research science technology center of IORA, and they are making efforts to mainstream gender into its regional initiatives and make contributions to technological advancement and knowledge transfer, looking at oceans medicinal plants, for example. It's a key example there. But the number and level of education of women in STEM still remains a large challenge. And no big surprise, The same applies with renewable oceans energy. Again, when we start digging around a little bit there, accurate data was difficult to find. We don't know how many women are involved in, let's say, wave energy technology, whether it be in Somalia, in South Africa, in Oman, or any other oceans country. We could see a significant expansion here, but again, education. It's going to come down to how many women are really involved in STEM education in order to really exploit this particular opportunity. The one key thing for us, not just for this sector, but for all sectors, is that policymakers within IORA, really, there needs to be a stronger political will and a stronger commitment to start gathering data on women's participation in the blue economy, especially in relation to technology. If you don't do that, then we don't know which way we're going. Tourism. I'm sure it will come as no big surprise that a great portion of tourist activity happens in coastal regions, right? We all want to go to Mauritius for holiday, go and experience the sandy beaches. And when you start looking at who is involved in the tourism industry, this is, again, it's an area where a lot of women are involved, but generally in an informal sector or generally in a non-managerial sector capacity. So looking at the research gap, so to speak, so mind the research gap here. Looking at the research gap, the first thing is we really do need to be more serious and committed to gathering gender disaggregated data across the sectors of the blue economy. If we don't do that, we won't know who participates, so representation. Although we have some data and they are case studies, you cannot really map the gendered nature of the blue economy accurately. And for that reason, you cannot fully understand the importance, but also the full economic contribution women make in this very important area of development. When we start looking at what is the state of women's economic empowerment in IORA, we really drew on a multi-dimensional approach. We looked largely at economic, socio-cultural, religious, education, health-related factors. All of these can ultimately define the boundaries that women need to overcome in order to really take up space within the blue economy. And Dr. Emmanuel Sakiri very kindly mapped out three dimensions for us that we focused on, and it's listed there. Economic empowerment that looked at labor force participation and vulnerable employment, socio-cultural access to finance, percentage of women in the National Assembly, and then education access to tertiary education. Because again, women who don't participate in the labor or are stuck in vulnerable employment will not be sufficiently empowered or cannot empower themselves to move forward. We need women's voices for policy making in national assemblies. A woman who controls her finances can control her future, as Melanie Gates so famously once said. So access to finance becomes important, as well as access to education. So just very briefly, this will give you an overview. This was labor force participation in 2000 by gender and population within IORA, as drawn from the World Bank. And if we fast forward, and my button's not working. There we go. And if we fast forward to 2017, we will note that, yes, women's labor force participation has increased, but it is generally still very male-dominated. So you're not really seeing that 50-50, so to speak. When you look at your vulnerable employment in 2000 and 2017, we note that women are still largely in vulnerable employment when compared to their male counterparts. we wanted to know when jobs are scarce, and we drew this, and again, thank you, Dr. Stephen Gordon, for looking at this data for us. When jobs are scarce, men should have more rights to a job than women. And this is part of the World Value Survey that really speaks to cultural attitudes. Now, if you kind of look at some of the findings, there seems to be general agreement with this statement, even amongst women. So it really plays into that idea that that traditional notion that men are the breadwinners. On the whole, men make better business executives than women. And again, the findings speak for themselves. You know, the large, relative to large agreement, even amongst the female population, when it comes to this statement, amongst others. I mean, we also looked at, I don't know if it's on, it is on the slide, so I won't spoil the surprise yet. Women in education, in tertiary education, again, sourced from the World Bank, male versus female. And when you fast forward to 2016, whilst we have seen increases in women's participation in tertiary education, women generally still lag behind. And it would be particularly interesting to see what is the level of difference in STEM education at PhD level, for example. Within Iora countries. This question, I'm sorry, I forgot to include the question there. The question was, a boy child is more entitled to a university education than a girl child on the World Value Survey. And again, what we find, you know, while in some countries there's strong disagreement, in quite a few countries, Bangladesh, for example, there's agreement, Yemen, so forth. Percentage of representation in national assemblies. So you can see the difference the percentage of political representation, men and women. And of course, South Africa, Tanzania also has relatively high female presentation between 2000 and 2017. The orange bar is 2017, the blue bar is 2000. In other countries, representation is relatively marginal. And we wanted to know, on the whole, men make better political leaders than women. And again, this is drawn from the World Value Survey. And again, one can see there seems to be some relatively broad agreement with this statement. So, you know, just looking at the state of women in Iora, what we are sitting with is what we have termed the empowerment gap. So mind the empowerment gap. And we really have a mixed picture, because in each of these dimensions, women are less empowered than their male counterparts. But you also have sociocultural attitudes that actually seem to perpetuate these ideas. So policy interventions, while they may differ between countries on emphasis and focus, there is a need to really start a narrative on the value of women and break down those stereotypes. Men make better leaders, better political leaders, better business executives, and so forth. Now, what we got from the elite interviews, we generally focused the question on what should be done. What are some of the initiatives that should be undertaken? And when we say elite, we did elite stakeholder interviews. We didn't interview famous politicians and women's advocates as much as we wanted to, but we interviewed academics and people who are really involved, either through study or on the ground or through NGO involvement in this particular area. So this presents kind of the steps towards women's economic empowerment for a blue economy. Quality research and data. We need gender mainstreaming and policy. certain interventions, capacity building programs, educational campaigns. Educational campaigns that don't just break down stereotypes. In fact, one of the elite interviews went as further to say that we need to break down the limitations women create in their own minds because of this particular scenario or situation or context that they found themselves in. Establishing contact with women's leadership networks, women's NGOs, to really start a broader conversation and to bring men into the conversation. Blue economy and women's economic empowerment. Again, gender stereotypes is a key challenge, sociocultural aspects, the need to create the space for self-empowerment came out very, very strongly. Some of the challenges that were highlighted that needed to be dealt with was a lack of understanding at a grassroots level of what the blue economy was. So there perhaps a stronger push within the schooling system to advocate blue economy. And just a broad understanding of the blue economy and how that can facilitate into an inclusive economic and developmental space that is socially just for overall human well-being. And note, I'm not saying woman well-being, I'm saying human well-being, because ultimately that is what we are working towards. So thank you, Michael, for allowing me to steal your Making the Road by Walking title. just some of the recommendations that we made, and I'm going to run through these very, very quickly, was prioritize capacity building initiatives, especially for officials and policymakers. It doesn't help that we are having these conversations. We need to look at, or we are having these conversations that we need to capacitate women for their empowerment. We also need to look at policymakers and officials who work with those policies and engage in some capacity building there. Awareness campaigns for women on understanding the blue economy and their role in it. Not just traditional female associated cultural stereotypical roles, but really the role they can play in the blue economy. Research collaboration, very important, especially across the regional organization, if we are looking at the key sectors of the blue economy and how women participate in those sectors. Academic collaborations, ministries of higher education to really invest in research and academic mobility and start looking at who is studying what at institutions of higher education within the countries. Engage NGOs that are involved in women's issues in key sectors of the blue economy. Think of trade unions, for example, or women-specific trade unions in fisheries, and some of the key obstacles and, you know, cross-country lessons learned there. We need to get the formal working groups within the Aurora space to start talking to one another. The Women's Economic Empowerment Group, as well as the Blue Economy Working Group, need to be in constant conversation, given that these are two cross-cutting themes where the blue economy will become the vehicle for women's economic empowerment. This is a very tricky recommendation, because we always say we need to facilitate and increase women's participation at Aurora conferences, seminars, training programs, and workshops. But we have to be specific about what workshops. As I've mentioned before, if there's a women's conference, right? Who mostly attends a women's conference? Are women. So we need to get more men involved in those conferences. If there is a, let's say for argument's sake, what would be traditionally male-dominated? Defense industry. We need to get more women in those male-dominated conferences as well. So for me, this really needs to be, there needs to be a strong political will to look at who we are sending to these conferences. And then finally, we asked for the development of a matrix, or we developed a matrix to start capturing the relevant data on women's economic empowerment. Of course, the first key one being gender aggregated data. And that is the end of my story. Thank you for your patience and listening, and I hope you found it thought-provoking and Phoenix.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. We do have some time for questions, comments, discussion. So perhaps I'll start in the Durban office. Is there anyone in the Durban office who has a question or comment?
Jolene, I have a quick one. It's Ben. I was just interested, obviously you took the elite opinion in terms of the stakeholders that you talked to and related back to some degree the data that you've managed to cobble together for the study. I was really interested in the idea of political will, and I think that pulled through to your conclusions. I was just wondering, from your expert opinions interviews that you did, the degree to which they gave a sense of the state of the IORA member countries. I think it's, if you look at the 21 states or so that form that membership, they're quite wide ranging, the level of patriarchy and the degree to which there has been gender, there remains gender inequality or not. So I'm just interested to see that, the extent to which you're getting that reflected. Building through to those recommendations that you made to King Rank, particularly capacitation of officials and policymakers. I think that's really critical.
No, it definitely is something that came through quite strongly. You know, there were a few of our elite interviewees who highlighted that when you start looking at the state of women in IORA, many of them would say it's the position of women is not that brilliant. And there was a lot of concern that when you look at the policy level, that there's a lot of talk, but very little walk. And the idea was that if we are really going to break down some of those stereotypes, really change the situation of women within IORA member states, especially in very poor states where women are particularly vulnerable, officials need to become policymakers. Need to become a little bit more serious about women's economic empowerment. So it's going to be interesting to see moving forward now as we approach 2021, how that is going to filter through into individual country policies. Because remember, this report was sent to all 21 member states. So I think we're waiting with bated breath now to see if our recommendations are taken or not.
Okay, another question from the Durban office. Okay, for now. Okay. Shall we go to Cape Town? Cape Town, are there any questions?
Jolene, from my side, Krishna from the Briggs Research Center. We had done a study on digital skills, and in particular women's involvement in getting access to digital skills programs. And one of the findings which emerged from India was that we had to be aware of the cultural norms which exist in that particular country. And as I looked at that, I used to wonder whether those norms that apply to India are as prevalent as they are here in South Africa. In this instance, when they spoke about cultural norms, it was about how do you challenge those cultural norms about giving women access to digital technologies. For example, if you're providing access to an internet cafe, the idea was that women wouldn't visit an internet cafe because that's where men attend. So what business does the woman have visiting such a facility? The other idea was that that you've got to try and change the way that you provide training opportunities, and you've got to take into cognizance issues of time poverty. And if a woman is active in the household doing chores and so on during the day, you need to schedule training programs in the evening in time slots more convenient, and also to have those training programs facilitated by a woman so that it becomes more conducive to a woman attending that particular program. Do you think those types of issues are specific to India or cut across the IORA region? And do you think that those are as relevant in South Africa as they are in India?
I think it's issues that cut across the IORA countries. And I also think it's issues that we would find generally in a South African context. I'll use an example. One of our interviewees did some work around this digital space and getting women to use social media to advertise their businesses. And there was this great fear of social media. It's there, but women were too afraid to use it. For example, fear of making a mistake, for fear of doing something wrong that might anger the husband, or whichever way it goes. For me, those cultural stereotypes around this is a woman's establishment, this is a men's establishment, this is a woman's space, this is a man's space, that is where breaking down those cultural stereotypes really, really kicked in and came through quite strongly within the interview data in particular. And hence the recommendation to say, we actually need an awareness campaign. And as one of the interviewers had said, it is not about empowering women, but also about women realizing that they are in charge of their own empowerment. So my question then back to you is how can we use the digital space in order to facilitate that? And that's kind of where the conversation for me would then begin as you start mapping out these policy recommendations even further.
Well, to respond to that, if I may.
Yeah.
So the idea for me is you can't be creating a space that is woman only. So you want to be providing opportunities which have access to everyone, but you want it to provide it in a way that is conducive for all to have access, and that you're not breaking, so that you are breaking down those sorts of norms or that do exist. So what I would suggest then is that we do need to think about who's providing the training, what sorts of programs are being made available, and do so in ways that are more open and seem less restrictive, I guess. And so we have to look at each individual training program in this instance and see how best we can structure these so that we do make these opportunities more accessible.
No, definitely. And I think for me, that would also extend into education and training. You know, that if you speak of a blue economy, for example, and you go into a schooling space, you know, do we have digital platforms where everybody, regardless of gender, is able to access content around science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, for example, if they want to pursue a more science-related career in the blue economy, which, as I stated, as technology and as science and all of those things advances, that's actually going to be a space where you can really facilitate women's economic empowerment.
There's also some interesting trends that we're seeing in terms of platforms here locally. And some platforms are very gender segregated. So you have new platforms providing you new opportunities to access work, but then you have your sweep subs and those that are providing domestic work, and it's almost 100% female employees that are subscribed to the platform. And so you're not enticing men to recognize that there is this working opportunity. Similarly, there's other platforms that are then largely male-driven. And so we're not then providing training opportunities for women to look at those avenues as viable streams of work, which would then allow them to enroll on these platforms. So I think it starts with the education systems where you challenge these norms, and then you start to increase your numbers, which then get access to different programs and then the technologies that support those programs.
Sounds as though you could have a useful offline continuation of this
yes.
conversation. But I did, if I may, I did want to bring to pick up on one aspect of Krisha's question, and that is, are there sensitivities amongst Iowa countries about comparing data for different countries, not just about women's issues, but in general?
That's a bit of a difficult one to answer. I didn't get the impression that there may be sensitivities. You know, it could just potentially be that this is how we capture data, this is always how we capture data, and this is the data that we've got to we carry on. But as I had mentioned, you know, it's this particular project focused specifically on the blue economy. And it's an emerging area, it's a new area. So, and I think that is where the biggest challenge lied in terms of, you know, saying, okay, listen, please, if you capture employment data on the blue economy, can we have a gender disaggregated, that we can really get a sense, not necessarily for a country-to-country comparison, because we also have to remember IORA as a regional organization, in terms of its levels of development, is very, very diverse. I mean, you have some of the poorest countries, your less, your LDCs to, you know, your richer countries or that are classified as first world or developed and so forth. But just to rather get a sense of, if you look at the IORA space overall, how and in what capacity are women involved in the blue economy, each of the key sectors, and based on that data, then what initiatives can we create?
Okay, I'll also engage with you offline. Cape Town, any other questions?
That's it.
Okay. Pretoria?
Thanks. My question is about the elite stakeholders that you interviewed, and I'm thinking especially in the countries where women are more marginalized. But did you interview any male stakeholders? And then as a follow-up, can those type of stakeholders then be used as possible ambassadors to influence the public?
Offhand, Michael can help me here. I don't think we had any male interviewees.
Well, we had one in Pretoria.
We had one in Pretoria.
Yeah.
No, two. The other one was from Madagascar.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had two male interviewees who worked in this space of either. Well, they worked in the blue economy space, but not necessarily with a focus on women's economic empowerment. So it was, we were able to bring in almost kind of their perspective as well, or the way they saw it. In terms of, let's say, the women and the men who sat for the interviews being ambassadors for women's economic empowerment in IORA, it's a very difficult question to say, are they yes or no? Some interviewees were very well known and very vocal in the space, and other interviewees wanted to remain completely anonymous for fear of any repercussion that may have come from their views being expressed in this project. So that was a key reason why we said we actually need to map out women's NGOs who are already active in those different areas, kind of create that regional wide network where they are able to engage with one another. And then through that, create that social mobilization and ambassadorship almost to start putting the women's economic empowerment in the blue economy agenda solidly on the policy table.
But I think if you have a few men that can promote the cause of women, that is a stronger change agent than having mobilizing a lot of women's NGOs. Because the men are less likely to listen to the women NGOs than to other men. It's just a
but also, men can be involved in women's NGOs.
Yes.
So that's kind of the perspective that we came from.
Yeah.
Because you do find some men are involved in women's NGOs, especially if it's, let's say, fisheries, maybe an issue that might also directly affect them. I think Nanya had the perfect example about women planting carbon, the mangroves, to reduce the carbon offset. Both men and women in poor communities are involved in that, but they're not necessarily getting the credit cash transfers. So it's one issue within the blue economy that effectively unites them in order to advocate and advance their issue.
Hashtag a few good men. Better.
Just title of the next report.
A bit of curiosity. Do you, in your analysis of women, also differentiate between single income households where the women are the only income producer, and the ones, for example, in families where they're married and the husband earns, let's say, a normal income? And the question would then maybe whether the wife would prefer to have the husband a higher salary, and she could play other social roles, for example, around the family. I'm just wondering, because we always talk about women as if they are one category.
Unfortunately, we only have 3 months and a very limited budget, so that particular aspect of the analysis didn't come in. But it's definitely a point to take as well, you know, looking at income distribution. But for this particular project, there just wasn't time and money, you know, the two major obstacles.
The one reason why I ask is, when we did years ago research on community water supply in the rural areas, there was this strong motivation for women not having to fetch the water from the river and tap in the village, etc., which we were fine. And one of the responses from a number of women was, well, it's the only time we get in the day to get off from home as women together to the water side and talk with each other, while under other circumstances we are always in a fixed sort of social situation. Mm-hmm. So that there may be situations where women may prefer to be in a group. I agree with the discriminatory, of course, but I'm always very wary about this categorization of women A and men B, and there's no, as if there is no differentiation socially.
Yeah, but that's also where social cultural attitudes start coming into play. Mm. So, you know, and once you start dealing with social cultural, nothing is ever black and white, as the saying goes. There's a lot of shades of, I want to say 50 shades of grey, but I don't think that's the correct.
Not in this context. Okay. Our video participant, do you perhaps have a question or comment?
I think she left.
She left.
We had a few people.
That one is IT. So IT. It's Tabo, who's managing it from upstairs.
Okay.
You know, Tabo, we had a couple of people online here.
Was it?
Alexander Kasioki.
Does Alexander Kasioki. I don't know.
Has he gone off?
There's only one. Alexander Kasioki.
Is Alexander with us?
Yes.
Okay.
Do you have a question, Alexander?
Hello, Alexander. Alexander, are you still connected? No, doesn't really.
Right, maybe.
Or maybe you are muted. Can you unmute?
Yes, okay, so we have two hands, Tuli in Pretoria and Stephen in Durban. Tuli?
My question is, I think it's probably unique to the annotation, but this is an exception, obviously, but did you find women who were sort of against the idea in the sense of, I'll use an example, for instance, there are women who are in the oil industry. It was very hard to get to where they are in that point. And when they hear discussions around, you know, empowerment and opening the floodgates for other women to come into the industry, there's always that twist or twinge that, you know what, I worked hard to get to where I am. And now, you know, we're just allowing people to walk in. So that competitiveness, was that a factor somehow?
You know, it came up a little in the interview data, but unfortunately we didn't have time, resources, or capacity to interview women on the ground, so to speak, for this particular project. We did another, this particular presentation we did for a workshop that the ISS had organized. And funnily enough, that issue also came up in the discussion. So it does seem, you know, that there seems to be, I think my impression is there seems to be a sense that I'm one of three women who work in whichever, let's say, seabed mining or whatever it is. And now you want to advance other women. Have you got any idea what I had to overcome in order to get here? And then almost becoming very protective of the space because of the difficulties. But again, I think that's where conversation needs to happen around that. And see, my whole thing is why do we become so protective of the space? And that's something that perhaps we need to start engaging as well. But that is a discussion over coffee.
Okay, Stephen.
Thank you very much. I was just wondering, given the significant differences we noted in the attitudinal data between Islamic Iora countries and non-Islamic Iora countries, a similar difference was noted in the expert interviews.
Yes. difference with?
Oh,
just the cultural attitudes
towards female empowerment and the pace and progress of female empowerment.
Well, let me answer your question this way, and perhaps that will give you a kind of the correct answer. The interviewees who requested anonymity were, in fact, from the Islamic Aura member states.
So, in anonymous interviewees, they displayed differences in how they responded to the question?
In terms of responding to the questions, I think there was a very solid and open discussion around the attitudinal stereotypes that actually impinge or undermine the women's economic empowerment agenda. So across the board with all the interviewees, your sociocultural attitudes and perceptions was something that kept popping up. To the extent that, as I've mentioned before, one interviewee said, this is not about governments empowering women. This should actually be about women empowering themselves. And a key first step towards that is realizing that those cultural barriers, so to speak, are merely hurdles to be overcome, that one can take up that space. But of course, in some countries, the women's economic empowerment agenda is a lot more sensitive than in other countries. And that also relates to the diversity of the of IORA as a regional organization.
Other questions?
Yes. Michael?
Derek.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm not sure if this is a question or comment, but I mean, in the Lalapan region, we have large-scale fishing farming, which is going to take place, and there's lobby groups kind of fighting this approach. So in our order, I see development and opportunities for women and upliftment of women, not only through job opportunities and economic development, but what is happening in Lalapan is where you would find women fighting against, you know, these employment opportunities because they argue it's detrimental to the environment. So in other words, you also find in parliament against situations where the situation is not governed well, where scoping analysis is not done in terms of the socioeconomic and the impact on the broader community. And it also impacts on the culture and heritage of the people, where small-scale fishing will still work perhaps. But here we're looking at large-scale farming, which government are backing. So I do also think that from a different angle, you would find that, you know, in this particular situation where you would find leadership about the community and the lobby groups, where one female and a couple of females, you know, are actually fighting for their rights to secure livelihoods through the traditional processes rather than this large-scale farming processes.
I referred a little bit earlier on to the example of men and women planting mangroves to kind of offset carbon globally and not being able and not getting their credit transfer, for example. Now, within the case studies that we did around this particular issue, both men and women are committed to doing that purely because they realize they have to protect the environment. They are an island state, and they realize that, you know, if we go up by 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, water levels would rise, which would essentially then impact on their homes. So there's kind of two narratives around this. And this is why I say what makes the blue economy so interesting, because its policy narrative is about environmental sustainability, social justice, human well-being. That's fine. The caffeine will kick in now, and hopefully I'll remember the fourth one. And within this blue economy space, as much as the focus is on development and, you know, bringing women into the blue economy, a key pillar of that is also that environmental sustainability. So for me, it's not necessarily a question of women or communities, for that matter, saying, we don't want large-scale development here. We rather want to do things the way we've been doing it. I think for them, it's more a question of, this is our home and we have to protect our home and then start collaborating. Because remember, women who are planting mangroves, for example, are not necessarily doing their unpaid care work at home. And the same goes for men. They are not necessarily doing whatever job they need to do in order to bring income while they're busy planting mangroves.
Okay, is there a last question someone wants to pose? Okay, so shall we bring the session to a close then? Thank you very much, Jolene, for some very interesting data. And I think the conversation can go further. So I want to encourage people around the tables, if you want to send comments to Jolene, if that would be all right.
Yes.
Any questions?
Yes.